Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. Thank you for the intro, G. This is, I'm Emily Pearson. This is the Main Course OG. Today is Thursday, April 11th. It's my half birthday, in case anyone, wanted to bake me half a cake. That's the version of happy birthday in for the half birthdays. Got it. I am in studio this morning with Patrick Martins, my co-host.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. And our guests for the weekly grill are Amanda Wilson and Liz McConnell of Union Square Hospitality Group. Good morning, guys.
Morning.
Thanks for being here with us. So we're going to jump right into our first segment, which we call the weekly based. We have a lot of topics to cover, and we might go through some of them fast. So let's get started. I want to talk about pre-batching food and alcohol. Is quality lost? So basically grab and go, pre-batch, convenience food, even artisanal bottled cocktails that Patrick's been drinking here at Roberta's. Is it the experience that's lost, or is there a loss of quality, in your opinion?
Anytime a restaurant makes the decision to pre-batch, and usually that would be like a grab-and-go restaurant, when they're doing it right, they've like figured out that salt pulls liquid out of cabbage or out of lettuce, so that's not seasoned. Like when you're getting a salad at a sit-down restaurant, they are adding dressing and also adding salt and pepper, because in the moment you're not messing things up by adding that seasoning there. You're making it better. You're being able to taste it. So anytime you're getting like a salad in a bowl with dressing attached, they haven't seasoned that salad the way they would in a restaurant. There might be a little more salt in the dressing so that you're getting the full experience, and the same goes for like a grain salad or something like that. They're always thinking about how it's going to sit on the shelf, what your experience is when you get it back to your desk to eat, or table. I guess people eat at tables too. Anyone who's doing it right is doing pretty well. I don't know about cocktails.
Do you guys do that? A Union Square Cafe? Is that part of being a good bartender?
Yes. Batching cocktails is quite trendy now, is from what I can tell. We're not cocktail experts, except for that we drink them, but I know similarly with food, like batching cocktails is almost like a must now. Everybody's in a rush. Everybody wants everything very fast. And I think as operators of food businesses, what Liz said, like, certain things about food where you can decide what you can pre-batch that's not going to really affect the quality, so you can get certain things out fast and serve more people, whereas some things you just can't, you can't do, and you wouldn't do that. But like a lot of menus, I think, are developed based off of what you can now get out to people really fast, what can sit longer, because people just like don't like to sit and eat as much as they used to.
Well, I think they need to have more, bartenders.
But that needs to be so like a money, bar. Patrick.
Well, I mean, cocktails need to cost more. I mean, Emily complains sometimes about the cost of cocktails, but I mean, it is basically has as many ingredients and takes as long as to prepare as an appetizer, which can be in $20 range. So, and it's almost like a barber shop. There's like five just great bartenders. They're like, oh, we got one. I'll take this one. And when it's really going, because pre-batching is just, there's got to be some loss in quality. But the funny thing is, very few people do great cocktails or great food anyway. So in that case, the batch is just as solid as an average in-person live.
But it's
made.
Cool. Like there are some, I know like Huerta, Strona Miller, he keeps some, like, I guess it's not a cocktail, but he keeps his vermouth on tap. Like there's all these sort of new cool of the moment things where like you can buy this very strong Negroni in a bottle that all you do is pour over an ice cube. But you kind of forget that like it's a cocktail that you could get at a restaurant and it's very strong and you don't just like down them at home.
It's
like,
also very solid. It's terrible. If it was terrible, it wouldn't work. It's like a good cocktail.
Yeah, or, I think you batch things that make sense batching and you don't for things that don't. And I think if you know cocktails well, you can decide what that is and what's not.
And but, I don't think that pre-batching means that you like lose the experience like with the bartender or like having this relationship. Right. Although I guess it is cool when you watch every single, you know, bitter and every component go in. I don't know. Certain cocktail culture to it. So we have to talk about Meghan Markle, our favorite duchess.
Do we?
Yes, we must. We always talk about her on this show. We must. So Meghan Markle has asked you to create a single bite for her upcoming baby shower for thousands of women from around the world. Do you innovate or do a classic?
Classic.
And what's your
really
bite?
Bold? Everyone says innovate.
Really?
Well, most people your age, no offense. I'm older. But Younger people say innovate. Older people say classic. That's basically.
But a lot of people say classic because, I mean, innovate because a classic might disappoint too many people. Everyone has their opinion about how.
A lot. Yeah, everybody. So the thing about classics is everybody has their best version of what they know as a classic. But if you can make the best version of a classic, that's going to make, I think that'll make more people happy than innovating, which could make a percentage of people really excited, but you might miss a little bit on the other side.
Hmm. Also, does royalty really care about food?
You know, Meghan Markle's yet to come on the show.
I was just going to say, has she been on the show
yet? She's
yet
to come on. We are waiting for when she gives birth, and then we will have the whole family.
The question is, do rich people eat well? And the funny thing is, I think it tends towards not necessarily for sure. Like, look at Silicon Valley. I think people basically, there's a not such a great restaurant scene there. I mean, those are some of the richest people in the world. I think they eat very fresh ingredients, but they don't necessarily eat the best. And then we sell to one of our favorite supermarkets, Gentiles, on the Upper East Side, to basically 83rd and Madison. So he sells to the richest people in the world. And a lot of what they want and feel comfortable with are the name brands like Oscar Mayer that they've seen for the past 50 years. And if you put like the Meat Hooks hot dog there, it just wouldn't move there. So even though it's a better quality ingredient and probably tastes more interesting, so I don't think rich people eat better. Some
maybe
people
that
get
also
it, some
like,
people
wait that goes to classic and innovate. It's like you've got the higher end bacon or whatever it might be next to the classic Oscar Mayer, and it's which is that person's preference. But what would your bite be?
I guess maybe like an apple tart with like cloth bound Wensleydale, like English specific. Cheddar cheese.
I was going to say I need a translation about, I know cloth bound, but then you lost me.
Oh, I like it's a really like gritty, I think it's a cheddar. It's been a long time since I've worked in cheese, but Anne would know.
I would do a caviar. This over a big potato chip, like those big dark or those orange potato chips, like those English kind of potato chips, you know, the really good chips, because they have fish and chips. So instead of french fries, they have chips. So the best chip with a huge mound of caviar.
Do you think that's what a bunch of British ladies want to eat, though?
But it would be exciting if it's only one bite.
I guess. Maybe a crumbled chip. Just like, you know, like a morsel of a chip. Oh, all right, what would your bite be if you're gonna do a classic?
I'm going to go with a tea sandwich.
Oh.
I thought about that too.
Are you going to go in the currently trendy Japanese egg cut off the edges sandwich?
Oh, yeah. Definitely no crust. Egg would be good. I like a little cucumber in there. But yeah, I just got to go classic.
Trust me. People don't like crust.
I've done so many events, and the more innovative you get, sometimes it just doesn't land. Not because the food's not good. Just like for the masses, people love, you know, what they love.
Well, will you say what Max, the chef of Mama Fuko Sambar, said about the classic innovative question? He said one cannot innovate until they understand the classics.
Oh, good. I like that.
So, yeah, you can innovate, sure, but only after this. And it's funny, the fear of young people on this show when asked that question, being like, pasta with cacio e pepe. Oh, no, too risky. The pasta has to be perfect. I'd rather innovate, you know, because there's less pressure on innovation.
Or, yeah, preparing. I mean, I think that's, you always see, like, in the movies or you hear the stories of the French chef who says, make me an omelet, mm-hmm. you know, and, like.
Yes. Or ratatouille, the rat, the simplest peasant dish to the greatest critic in Paris. You saw the movie Ratatouille?
I did, yes.
Okay. She's like, but it's been a while. Are you going to quiz me on it?
Very long time.
Patrick, yeah, and I usually like to say...
It's always harder to do classics because mm-hmm. you have to do them perfectly.
Well, yeah. You know what one chef said?
And what does that even mean?
I'm afraid that the people who I'm serving won't even know what they should... They're like, this pasta's simple. It doesn't even have tomato sauce on it. You know, like... There could be a misunderstanding of what a classic is.
Patrick's in a caviar phase. He used to say he wanted the perfect, like, everything bagel, smoked salmon, cream cheese, capers, pickled onions bite.
Wrapped in an egg.
That's a good bite.
Wrapped in an egg.
Well, that's one of my favorite bites. So is the Peking duck with the hoisin sauce and the skin.
That's a good... That's actually my one of my... That's probably my Peking duck is my death row meal.
Oh really?
Yeah. Your death row 100%. Last supper.
100%.
Mine's always pizza.
Can I make a confession that could get me thrown off this show and fired from the network?
You've never had Peking duck.
I don't love corn tortillas. You know, I love flour tortillas.
I didn't love corn tortillas until I went to Mexico City and had a real corn tortilla. So it's
but I also think we've been talking, well, Patrick and I were just in a conversation the other day about tamales. And he's like, I don't like that they're like this mealy corn consistency.
Maybe you have a cornmeal
thing. But I think he has a cornmeal issue. Mm-hmm. And maybe until you go to Mexico.
Yeah,
and have it done properly. Have you been
to Mexico?
Properly.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I've been to Mexico.
That's like someone saying they don't like a bagel because they only had one from
Cincinnati.
Yeah.
No, there's one.
I was gonna say Ohio.
That's the newest thing where they're cutting it down the middle.
Sorry for anybody listening out there in Cincinnati.
Oh, I've been hearing about that, where you cut the bagel in half instead of
no, sliced down. Not it's not like one cut. It's like let's take this bagel, set it on the table, the prep table, and then like. Yeah, and then cut slices of it. And I have to say, like, I'm not a New Yorker by any means, but it doesn't offend me.
Why are you whispering?
I'm not ashamed.
New Jersey, most people would claim to be almost a New Yorker.
No,
if they
she,
live
I
in
like
Jersey.
The way she said like it. She's like, by any means, I am not a New Yorker. That's good. That's correct.
No, as New Yorkers, we appreciate it.
I've made a conscious choice to have quality of life. And fewer restaurant choices.
Maybe she gave us a diss just now.
I know. Seriously, we have trees here. We have probably more trees than in New Jersey. So this is a test. If you love tacos, but it's only a corn tortilla place, what is the savior for a flour lover? The quesadilla. Yeah, it always has. 99% of the time it's made with flour.
There's never corn quesadillas?
I've almost never seen one.
No.
Why? Because it gets too mushy.
I think
it crisps really nicely.
I think the
flour
is
a better crisp on a griddle,
and that's important. Soggy quesadillas are
too much cheese for the corn. Like the cheese ratio with the corn tortilla would not work as well. The melted.
Maybe it also doesn't photograph as well, which is taking me to our next topic.
Nice transition.
Nice segue.
I'll try. So we read an interview with Danny Meyer on Thrillist, and he was talking about social media and the guest relations team and this whole sort of new wave situation of keeping an eye on your guests through social media. And he said social media has become somewhere in between the town square of 100 years ago, where you get your news and gossip, and also a postcard, like a snapshot of what's going on in time. What do you guys think about social media in the workplace or in the restaurant scene?
Social media in the restaurant scene is so horrifying.
Really?
Should I say that? Like,
it's something we have
this
to
is
think
your
out
opinion.
About a lot.
Yeah, that was a strong opinion. Let's backtrack.
But wait, you're in the kitchen.
So I'm in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I don't know if everybody listening knows. So my background is a chef, more or less fine dining.
You were chef of Union Square Cafe.
I was,
with Carmen for years.
And so in that environment, you don't create food around an Instagram picture. And now you do. So now I'm actually transitioned to taking over operations for Daily Provisions, which is a fast casual Danny Meyer restaurant. And it's great, but we talk a lot about the fact that it's so prevalent, and it's just changed. I wouldn't say it's horrible. I just said for a it's you have to switch your mind as a culinary person to when you're creating.
So what are you making food prettier now or?
Not necessarily. Prettier is a harder.
How has it changed your?
It's grill, really direct. Bring up the grilled cheese is a good example. Like we're creating a grilled cheese, normally you'd say like, oh, okay, like let's just make a great grilled cheese and like the best, you know, flavors and whatnot, but now it's like, but no, what's going to get that pull so it'll take a really good picture, or let's design a sandwich that's this high so it looks really cool, but maybe you can't even eat it.
It's so funny. It's putting so much power into the man on the street. There is nothing that I find less interesting than man on the street interviews. They're like, what do you think about the weather? I'm like, I don't care what that guy thinks about the weather at all. I want a weatherman who's a professional who's going to tell me what I should be thinking about the weather. Man on the street. But it does put a lot of energy. I mean, we always talk about Yelp being dead. But social media, the individual, has power to say, this is beautiful food. Go eat there.
Well, so part of what this article was about was this idea of keeping an eye on your guests. You can only get so far as a floor manager or as a maitre d' and to know exactly who's in your dining room. And I know traditionally fine dining restaurants do keep an eye on who their guests are, and they do a little research for certain reservations. But the idea that this is like a la minute, this is as it's happening. It's someone sitting at your bar and tagging that you guys are there. You know, are you gonna make the burger extra pretty because you know that the person's next course is coming? Like, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, we do. We keep an eye out if we know someone is a blogger or a big influencer. That's the name, right?
Yeah.
It's an influencer. Okay.
Although I guess we're all influencers or want to be influencers now.
I don't influence that many people.
I'm my own influencer.
Okay.
Sure, maybe we pay a little extra attention to what that food looks like. And that's actually the scary part is, you know, you're on your Instagram feed and you can follow hashtags now, so I'll follow the ones from, like, our restaurants. And, like, anybody can post anything, so even if something's plated beautifully, you have no control what that person does with that food, and then they're posting these pictures that, like, you wouldn't necessarily post that represent your brand now. So that's always something that...
Why not send a person through the dining room, a professional, and be like, do you want me to take an Instagram shot for you that's a lot better than the one that you'll post?
Or, like, the lighting's not great this evening.
They're usually pretty good.
Also,
do you want to see your dish in the kitchen before it comes to you for... $5 extra dollars.
Those people bring lights with them. Like, they set up their whole
thing. I was going to say, if
you're... And they're actually better photographers than, you know, if we were to get somebody in to, like, shoot 20 plates,
well, I'm not
that
talking
Instagram
about
photo
those
might be more
you,
Instagrammable yeah. than
sure.
what we
I'm just
would
talking
pay for.
About you know, Joe who comes in and just snaps in bad lighting a picture of something and then posts it and tags the restaurant. And
right, but if Joe's a decent photographer, then he... probably has more followers, and if he's not,
you
he
guys
has
are
fewer
all, you,
followers.
Yeah,
he's
that's,
less of an
that's
influencer.
True. That's true. And also, you guys are pretty smart. Most of your restaurants have good lighting, so there's like good natural lighting shots. There's dark, like cool, funky restaurants.
Too.
What about a town crier who's like, hear ye, the coffee is, you know, new batch of coffee. It just like updates people. That's town square. Old
that's like
town
the
square.
Twitter parking feed for Alternate Side. No.
Twitter parking fee for Alternate
like there's,
Side.
Yeah, like yeah, you can yeah. follow Alternate Side Parking in New York, and it tells you like when it's suspended, when it snowed. I feel like that's like a...
That's the
no.
time. Yeah. Is oh, that the Times Square the element of this? Before? I don't... I'm not on the Twitter.
Well,
I'm
what happened with the town square is they were basically barbarian hordes were running through Europe, and no one could settle. So when that finally slowed down, the Vikings were one of the last group. They built these town halls, archives, and that's where all legal stuff happened. So it was the town square where someone would be like, Liz just bought Amanda's tractor or horse. And enough people heard it that if you ever reneged on the deal or if the horse died the next day, you know, enough people were like, hey, that's not fair.
So now it's been said on social media. This is the best... Well, you guys got voted, what, the best Italian sandwich, breakfast sandwich, right? At Daily Provisions?
When it opened,
it was one of the like Grub Street pieces yes. that like you guys were they do the roundup of like best breakfast sandwiches.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great. I mean, don't get me wrong, chef brain, hard to adjust to social media. Business operator brain, it's great. You get your product, like more people see what you're doing. If you are lucky enough to have one of those like really Instagrammable that happens to also be delicious dishes, like it gets more people in the door, and like you can't argue with that. We have a good team that we work with that does like a lot for helping us bring people in the door, and like we wouldn't be able to do what we do if they weren't there. So it's great.
I was kind of hoping you'd be like, I don't care what my food looks like. It's about what it tastes like.
You know, it could be the ugliest food ever.
Not at Danny. I mean, Danny Rand's a shiny star.
An Instagram of just ugly food.
Food. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Well, Lizette, the worst photos on Instagram history, there's like a website or an Instagram feed of the world. Like 70% of them are lasagnas.
I think probably the only cool looking one is when Del Posto does their, like, what is it, the 100 layer?
Oh,
and if you get that side angle. But otherwise, yeah, from the top, forget it.
Yeah.
So, what cities outside of New York excite you both right now for food? Amanda, I know you were just in the Bay Area for a bread stage.
I did. I just spent 6 weeks out in San Francisco working out there to learn how to make bread because San Francisco is known for that sourdough. So the Bay Area, San Francisco is, oh God, can I say this in New York? It's probably my favorite food city in the United States.
Really?
A lot of people say New York is actually a descending food city on this show.
Yeah, we like to ask about ascending versus descending food
cities. I would probably agree with that. And even though the fact that I've been cooking in New York most of my career and probably am not leaving it anytime soon. But
why, because of classics or because of innovation, like ingredients or innovation?
Wait, New York?
No, San Francisco. Oh,
I think because of just ingredients. I mean, you'll go to almost any restaurant, and I went to, I ate a Petit Crène. A good friend of mine is the general manager there, and she drops this beautiful trout dish, and she goes, underneath are these pink peppercorn branches from that tree you'll see right outside. Yeah. It's like, come on, we can't do that in New York. Okay. So, the ingredients out there are just so amazing. There's this like secret about California that I think they just hoard all their best produce and don't give it to anybody else. So you've got to go there to really experience it. Mm. All the small farms, a lot of restaurants have their own farms out there, and not even talking about like the big 3-star ones, just a lot of restaurants just work with small farms and have their own. So they're just getting better quality ingredients. They're very seasonally driven. They can innovate, I think, a little better because their seasons overlap more than New York. New York is so hard to cook in if you want to be seasonal for like 6 months out of the year.
Yeah, spring and fall are brief.
So yeah, know? I'm a big California food fan, but not leaving New York anytime soon.
Yeah, well, and next question too, and for both of you guys, from coast to coast and everywhere in between, where do you think America stands in terms of food quality? I mean, against France and Italy and China.
Yeah, I think we're in a tough spot. You know, like, it feels like every positive trend towards food improvement has to be co-opted, you know, figure out some way for corporations to make more and more money off of it, how to simplify it, like the whole organic situation. And I don't think it's something that other countries deal with quite as much. The fact that the way that a vegetable is seen on the shelf at Walmart, what the price on it is, what labels on it, how that reflects for consumers, we've lost the sense that that this trend is actually important, that change is actually important, and that people will relate to it in that way. That relationship between consumer and farmer gets just further and further apart because
so you have no faith in them?
Corporate interests in them. Well, I'm really cynical
about the public to put their money where their mouth, you know, to buy.
They don't know any better. Sometimes, like I spend 3 days a week in the Green Market. I don't spend the whole day there. I'm only there for about an hour more in the spring and summer. But I'll hear people walk through the Green Market and they're very concerned with whether or not things are organic. Which is not really an issue when we talk to our farmers, you know, like the fact that they're making decisions to keep their crops as clean, as high quality as they possibly can, is all that I'm really concerned about when we're buying. And I know that those farmers are making the best decisions that they can. And the choice of whether or not to buy into like an organic stream of revenue by getting certification, by buying organic pesticides, organic fertilizer, in a lot of cases that are more heavily laced with chemicals that just happen to fall under that certification, it's not a factor when we buy vegetables, and it's unfortunate that for the most part, the common market, supermarket shopper just doesn't know. They still don't know.
About the organic issue, but I mean, in that vein, they don't know, you know, it's good that they're asking for organic, but I think most people don't, I think they feel safe with the corporation. They're just like, that's what I knew, that's what I grew up. They don't see, whereas we on the coast are like, that corporation is outrageous. Do you know what they do when they're, I just think like most Americans don't care if, you know, Mondelez has young workers work. I mean, they're not going to stop buying
As long as it says organic or gluten-free or like Ritz has cracker. The right...
Is anyone going to stop buying Ritz because there's some new local guy in Detroit that's making a better... I mean, that's sold in two places. It's like convenience. And I don't know. I don't harbor much hope for it changing. Although when Carlo Pacini came and saw the Good Food Awards, he looked out onto those 500 winners from all the categories like jam and... confections and spirits and cheese, and he was like, America is not the laughing stock of the world anymore. He's like, show me this many people in France or in Argentina. There's actually might not be, and some of the foods they're making are very good. So anyway, he really did believe in us, but I don't know if that's affecting all the people in all the country.
I worry also that maybe the Instagram culture and the way that food looks is becoming more and more important to people, and the origins of that food and the quality of the ingredients, the quality of the preparation, less so. So I worry that the Instagram food scene is taking away from the local heritage, you know, regional products and excellent preparation.
But do you think Instagram... like helps elevate maybe the green market and emphasizes that like it's cool, and I guess it's not just having aspirational hopes for your Instagram, but it's like I don't know, it's actually going to the market. Or are people just photographing it, or are they actually buying it, or are they just like, oh, this is pretty, but I'm still gonna go shop where at the bigger box store where it says organic?
I think it's a little both. I see a lot of people who just walk through the market with their hands empty taking pictures. I don't know,
taking pictures with them with the newspaper with today's date on it, being like, here I am at the farmer's market today, but then they don't buy anything.
maybe they got a cider.
Yeah, maybe they get a cider. I don't know.
There's well, what's too. Your spirit food? That's what I really want to know. This is the question I've been waiting for. This is my question.
Spirit food.
Like a spirit animal.
Yeah,
spirit
what's food. Your spirit animal while we're at it?
We start with animal?
Sure.
I know my animal. Food right. is harder. a slow loris.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know
and
what
if
that
you
is.
Don't know what that is, look up, go YouTube, slow loris eating a rice bowl.
What is that? Like a sloth?
Yeah, kind of like sloth. Like they have like super big eyes, and like they're just—I don't
but
know.
You seem fast enough to me. I mean, you don't seem particularly sloth-like.
I actually can't explain why this is my spirit animal.
Is it just the way you feel?
It's just
the
way I feel on the inside okay. when I see a slow loris eating a rice ball.
So, could your spirit food be the rice ball?
It could be.
Would it be something from Daily Provisions?
Yeah, oh, maybe.
Are you very nocturnal?
A because bacon a slow, slab.
Slow loris is a nocturnal primate.
There you go.
Oh, nice. Those are my favorite. But what do you have?
Food. Food's hard. I thought about. I've you know. Food is. How can you pick one spirit food? I might go with.
I'd be a radish, maybe, oh. a little tart.
Whoa, is that what you were going to say?
Look, well, yeah, because I have a radish tattoo.
Oh, nice.
So maybe a radish.
I like radishes. They're a little, what is that? What are they, spicy?
They're
right?
spicy, yeah. but deceiving. They're very cute, but like they got a little spice.
Yeah, their look and their color does not translate
cute.
To how they taste.
No.
Round.
Okay.
Round. So I have a lot in common
cute,
with them.
Round.
Spicy.
Yeah,
with the tail.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So the radish is your spirit animal?
I would say rice. I would say, yeah, radish is my spirit food. My spirit animal would unfortunately probably be like a goat.
Why is that unfortunate?
Sneaky. You know, I wish it would
They're
be
climbers.
Like a lion or a cheetah.
Goats are
giraffe.
Playful, though, too.
That's true.
They like to stand on things.
You know, our slaughterhouse will not allow the goat farmer to leave the goats in the pen and drive away. They have to stay till every last goat is gone because they will escape.
They're too smart
they
and they
just
don't. They're
smart.
They climb.
Escape.
Goat's that. A good one.
I'm a prairie dog.
What are you? Oh, prairie dog?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think aspirationally, I'd like to. Aren't elephants very wise?
It's power animal is not an aspirational animal. It's just a reality animal. I think it's who you really are. No?
I think it's the way the animal makes you feel.
I like to be like clean and neat. I don't know. I guess I'm a cat. I like that. I'll go with that.
Cat's a good one for you.
Yeah. I don't know. My answer for all things food is always something cheese.
I like that they're very versatile.
It could be a little funky. It could be a little melty. I guess I'm not that versatile. All right. I'm going to stick with that for now. Number one favorite food business in America right now. No ifs, ands, buts, or qualifiers.
Heritage Foods.
Yeah. I didn't pay for that. I swear.
Next question. What is the state of food? Do we talk about, you still order on Amazon all the time, right?
I order big box things and things that I don't want to, that I have, like I order paper towels and toilet paper on Amazon.
But not food?
No.
Well, I guess I would say mine is Petrosian right now. The caviar people. I mean, they deliver to you the world's greatest delicacy. I mean, people could say the truffle, although I've never been like, I love how strong truffles smell, real truffles. But caviar, I mean, is there a greater delicacy? I ask a lot of chefs, are caviar worth it? And they're like, yes, I love it. You know, all the breeds, the varieties, how long it takes them, 8 years to grow and...
Yeah, no?
You're not in the caviar.
No, I love caviar. I'm not rich enough to know, to have tried enough caviar, but in tastings when I get the good stuff, mm-hmm. that's when you know there's such a difference. Mm-hmm. I think just not a lot of people have had the good stuff.
I just wanted to have it enough in my life so I could speak to the four varieties of. I mean, I couldn't say a single thing. I knew some were orange and some were black. So this was like a short-term kind of investment to understand the world's greatest delicacy, maybe, which is a fish.
I think my favorite food business right now is, I don't know if you went while you were in California, but the Byright Family Markets.
Oh, I did.
There's something very special about sort of, and in general, that... mid-size family market that really cares about where they source from. Agreed. But I guess like the way you're referring to Gentile's maybe has multiple different brands. They're supporting local. They're also national. I love that Byright gives you a taste of the fruit. Like they, if there's, well, also only in California.
So you can take a bite out of an apple?
Again, very California. No, is there a Byright of New York? Like, is there like...
Byright is a liquor store nearby.
but is like, there? It doesn't feel like it. No, it's hard to explain unless you've been to Byright, but you're totally right. It's such an amazing feel of almost like old school as you go to your local grocery store and it's all like, there's everything that they source has like a story behind
it. It's colorful. It's rich. Every inch of shelf is
used. It could have been like the early days of Fairway or Dean and DeLuca or maybe Citarella, but the way that they've maintained it and that you, I think, yeah, it's a higher price point, but anyway, in California, it's the only place you can probably have like 10 different kinds of mandarin oranges, and so they'll have it like pre-peeled, not an apple, but they will cut things up for you to taste.
Yeah. When Sergio and Andrew and Francine had the Brooklyn Larder, every inch of that store was something that they had pickled or cure put up or something, you know, ramps and for martinis, and it was unbelievable to walk through that place, although they didn't have everything. They weren't trying to be a full market. I mean, it is amazing. I think Byright even sells like toilet paper and Bounty paper
and they
towels.
Sell wine, they sell everything. Yeah. And like here you can't necessarily do that, like if you don't have a liquor license you can't. They do a partnership to have their own wine.
Yeah, they do their own ice cream too. It's amazing.
They have a
and
creamery.
I love their fish counter, which we could never do in New York. I think for the most part they just have like four or five fish there, and they're like, these are the best fish and this is what we have. They don't feel the need to have 90 fish, you know, in some big colorful display where most of the fish are bad and only a few are good anyway, you know.
Also something I've noticed in California, because I guess of the bread scene being local and strong, there are, I don't know, like 15 different fresh breads that came in from 15 different artisanal producers that probably came only from like a mile away, you know, whether
and
it be
that,
Acme.
And all that grain is local farms too. That's another thing is they're using. So the bread stage I was doing was really cool because we did a traditional sourdough and would manipulate the recipe or have to adjust based off of like, we get these 20 pound bags of flour in and like everyone was like a little different and you adjust to that. But they're, you know, from farms like 50 miles away, milling very fresh flour, and that's something that like is definitely missing from New York, that culture of bread, I think. It's getting better. It's getting better here, I think.
Regional flour.
Yeah. We do, yeah.
We buy it from Maine. We just got a pallet yesterday.
Yeah, so yeah. We do. So it's definitely getting there. There's, don't get me wrong, there's great bread in New York, but there's something special about that San Francisco culture.
In the 70s, my mom, we had Wonder Bread, or we'd have to drive to a different neighborhood and take like a $5 cab ride like across town to get fresh bread. And then Eli Zabar, the son, opened on the Upper East Side. That was the first time that the Upper East Side, unless you live next to Ore Washers on that block on First Avenue or something. It was amazing. I mean, people, no one had fresh bread. Now almost every neighborhood in the country has some access to fresh bread, and it's really great in a few places, so.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk a bit more with Amanda and Liz about Union Square Cafe and Daily Provisions. Stick around.
Stick.
Amanda, why'd you leave? Let me put me down on my knees. Pray to be there, Lord above.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive Chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Coral Lee, and I'm the host of Meant to be Eaten here on HRN. Every week, I look at cross-cultural exchange in food and contemporary media. What determines authenticity? What, if anything, gets lost in translation when cooking foods from another's culture? You can find Meant to be Eaten wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
One night only?
All right, we're back.
All right, we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are with the women who run Union Square Cafe and Daily Provisions, Liz
exactly.
McConnell.
Oh,
and,
sure, yeah.
Yeah, and Amanda Wilson. Thanks for being with us, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we were talking before the break about bread baking, and I know that there's quite a bit of that done for Daily Provisions. Amanda, you have a new role running. Are you the executive chef now?
Technically, culinary operations is more my title, I guess. Yeah, I was at Union Square Cafe for a very long time. Grew in that business, opened the new one on 19th Street and as the chef, and then just recently in the last couple months moved over to take over operations for culinary operations for Daily Provisions. Mm-hmm. Same company and actually same kitchen.
Wow.
So didn't have to move far for the job change.
And tell us what's going on.
Daily Provisions?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it is an all day cafe. We are open breakfast, lunch, dinner, three different menus, focusing on daily provision. So whatever you trying to be everything for everyone, which is hard but fun. Breakfast sandwiches for breakfast is our main thing, but we bake, like we were saying, we bake all our bread in house. So retail bread, pastries in the morning. We are Instagram famous for our crullers, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So we do an in-house hand piped donut, and then we switch over to lunch sandwiches, salads in the afternoon, and then dinner is more, you know, traditional. I like to say it's what you would cook at for your family or what you would cook at home, but somebody else gets to cook it for you. So
I know you do a lot of rotisserie chicken.
We
right?
do rotisserie chicken.
It's basically trying to be something for everybody, but you still have to pick. You have to pick, like, what's your soup going to be? What's your salad going to be to still be
right.
for everybody? So then you also have, like, a grilled cheese, because who doesn't love a grilled cheese? But then if you want, like, a short rib kind of braised meat, there'll be that, you know? So
right.
it's basically one of every category.
We like to say if you live in the neighborhood, it's your neighborhood kitchen, and you could theoretically go three times a day and get something very different. And
but
something,
not even that. You can go 7 days in a row
right.
for dinner and be like, ah, I have their equivalent of a focaccia kind of bready thing yesterday. I want to go more bouillabaisse soup, and there'll be something that it really throws. You can go 7 days a week and never be eating the same type of style.
Neighborhood kitchen, that's like kind of our thing. So we are on 19th Street. Again, attached to Union, different entrance, but attached to Union Square Cafe, that kind of opened almost around the same time. And we are expanding daily provisions to the West Village this summer, and then the Upper West Side, hopefully later in the later by holidays this year.
And you'll have more Shake Shacks at what year? What's your goal to have more daily provisions than Shake Shacks?
That I don't 2020? Know. We're just focusing on those next two.
Okay.
Getting to the West Side. More provisions to more people, and then we'll see after that.
I think you chose some really good neighbors. Danny, everybody chose some really good neighborhoods, because those are neighborhoods that appreciate that you can go 7 days a week.
Hyper local.
Yes. Yeah. And that's the challenge, is like, we want, it is a neighborhood feel. We have such awesome regulars who do come 7 days a week. And so we want to make sure that the West Village and the Upper West Side like feel that too. It's not, you know, it's a different business in the sense of we want to be something for everybody. And that's hard to do.
Commissary kitchen, or will everything be prepared by chefs on site?
Working on that. Our West Village location is small because it's West Village, and so probably have to do some commissarying from the 19th Street location to get to Bedford, but Amsterdam's or Upper West is a much bigger space, so we'll be able to do our own cooking out of that kitchen.
That's awesome. Yeah. We can't wait to visit all of them.
Very fun, yes.
Absolutely. I told my mom about the Upper West Side. She was super excited. Mm. So, Liz, you were talking about the Green Market before, and that you're there 3 days a week. Tell us a little bit more about sort of that foraging and relationship experience with the farmers and translating that to your chefs.
Well, I don't do any foraging myself. You need a license for that.
I guess I'm embellishing the word a little.
It's okay.
Taking creative license.
Totally. I'm the purchasing manager for Union Square and Daily Provision Cafe and Daily Provisions. I worked with Amanda for a long time at USC. Actually, my first day interviewing for a job, she was on the pasta station, and I was like, this lady knows how to cook, and I'm excited to.
Thank you, Liz. Wow.
Yeah.
Now look at your destinies. Inspired me.
And
your
look at this. I know.
So at the Green Market, it's very experiential. Like I know the schedule like the back of my hand. I know which farmers are going to be there on which days, and I know those farmers pretty darn well at this point. So it's a lot of intuition, and it's a lot of knowing what when we decide to go on something to buy a vegetable that's back for the spring, back for the summer, it's a matter of me thinking and me talking to our chefs about, like, are they ready to go? Are we? Am I going to buy this thing that looks amazing, but then, like, you know, have to push somebody to find the time to get it on the menu? Or are we? Can we bring it in, get it cleaned, and get it straight on the menu that day? And it's always like this, the latter is always what we prefer. And there's always things that I know that we can jump right on, like overwintered broccoli rabe is something that Chef Carmen loves to just very quickly cook and toss with chilies, and it's delicious.
When you say, okay, this fruit or this vegetable's back, do you go back through years past menus and say, or do you just say, what do we want to do with this now, and kind of innovate, or do you return to some?
It's a little
process?
Of both. Yeah. I think it's definitely a little of both. There For are sure. like classic. Preparations that we, and classic for USC, like Union Square Cafe is a long standing restaurant. Chef Carmen's been working there for 14 years. Yeah, that sounds right. And his style is very California, so he's used to like taking that quick fresh approach to all of the produce that exists in California and applying it with, you know, the Italian style that USC has to all of those vegetables.
So what does that mean he does? Will you guys just take something and serve it with oil and vinegar and that's it, because totally. It's such good ingredients, mm-hmm. like Chef Eastwood? Or do you have to Italian it or Union Square it?
No, I think that the goal is to do that, is to find those best ingredients and not really have to do much to them. And that is very Union Square Cafe, but make sure whatever you get, you are treating it correctly, seasoning it correctly, and then you don't need to do that much with it. You know, it's a mixed menu of some things are a little bit more composed, and the goal of Union Square Cafe, in my opinion, cooking there for so long, is just that, is to keep things simple, delicious, well-executed, use that green market and be as seasonal as possible and let the food kind of come through. The ingredients, yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. You guys, you made me hungry. We think we have to go to Union Square Cafe or Daily Provisions for lunch.
Ramps are back. Speaking of foraging, ramps are back in.
I was just going to say,
in the market as of Wednesday.
You foraged your own ramps on your hike the other day, Liz.
No, I did not forage those. That was state land.
We're not going to speak of that.
No, but I do think somebody actually put them there because there was like a clump at the trailhead. Like they could even drive past their ramps and be like, oh yeah, they're ready, all right, I'm coming back, because there's that clump and there was a clump like inward, and then we walked 4 miles over like varying terrain and totally different moisture content, temperature, and no other ramps anywhere on that trail. So
they should make the Grand Bouffe.
Liz's intro to ramp foraging.
The crazy French movie, is it? Italian movie, Le Grand Bouffe, where they stuffed themselves to death. But just some hyper-local person from Vermont or something who just eats themselves to death on ramps and fiddleheads. That'd be a great movie.
It probably would be preserving.
Though. It would be there Le is Grand a movie. Bouffe Are you local.
About I think it's called The Forager.
Who dies from just
I don't know if
foraging.
Patrick wants someone to die because of overconsumption of something ridiculous.
Because they're so hyper-local. They're just like, I have to take
Way
advantage of the season.
Morels.
Yeah, just like, fiddleheads.
As long as it wasn't from the bacon consumption.
So we always want to ask about Danny because, you know, he's like the Steven Spielberg of restaurateurs, you know, he's untouchable, he's on top of the game and all that. So is there a particular lesson that you carry with you, like right now or in general, more than other lessons?
There's a lot. I would say the most recent thing that's coming to mind that he just said that I appreciate and love is smile more, talk less.
Did he say that directly to you?
No.
It would be the opposite for me. He would be like, smile. Oh, whoa. Talk more.
I think not just for me, in general, just in the hospitality industry, you know, smiling and eye contact go a long way. And I think people just tend to, you know, maybe talk a little bit too much and dig holes for themselves. Just smile. Say thank you, you're welcome, and that's it. It's good. Good advice.
We always want our guests to know that we're on their side, and I think just making eye contact in this world where everybody's, like, staring at their phones and walking around with tunnel vision is, like, it means a lot to anyone who walks through the door, whether it's Daily Provisions or USC.
No, you've been doing a great job with our listeners with eye contact, so it's great. You've done a great job today.
We're working on the smiling, talking less, just smiling.
Can you have one show where you just smile and nothing is aired at all?
Well, no. Well, we have the How to Tie Knot show.
Basket weaving.
Exactly.
I like the salt shaker. And this is like it's an old school USHG, that's Union Square Hospitality Group, trope. And the idea is that when you're managing your staff or anyone and you need them to get the point of something you're asking them to do, you're trying to get this point across, you're trying to make sure that they're doing their job, Danny calls it moving the salt shaker. And so basically, like, if you think about a dining table in a restaurant, the salt shaker is supposed to go in a very specific place. That's the instruction. That's what you want. When you need to make that adjustment with your staff, it's just like continually moving that salt shaker to the middle of the table or wherever it's supposed to go. No drama, no like questions like, why aren't you getting this? So when you get very frustrated in management, to remember, like, I'm just moving the salt shaker on this. I'm just reminding them again that I need, like, this is what I need from you. Please do your job. Please move the salt shaker to the back, to the where it goes, middle of the table.
My management style is like, sell the restaurant because the salt shaker thing will never be fixed. We are finding a new line of work for everybody. we'll have an alumni association. We will put you all onto great jobs, but we will never have that salt shaker problem again. Just kidding.
Patrick anyway. Just got way too intense for the closing of the show.
Wow. Emily's like, wow.
I was like, and how do I recover from just this? Kidding. Anyway.
Something about bacon.
Yeah, yeah. Just bacon. About that's bacon. All.
Well, thanks for all your
bacon.
Support. We love that you guys support so many small producers, including our farm. So
yeah,
it's great to have you guys. We'd love to have you on all the time. Once a season.
For ooh. Sure. Yeah. Nice. We'll cover what's changing on the menu once a season.
What
yeah.
I've been foraging.
Exactly what you've been foraging.
Yeah. I'll think more about what I want to make for Megan when she comes.
Okay, perfect. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, most
we'll wait till the babies
question.
Are here okay. and Megan and Harry, and we'll do we'll set the
we'll
table for them.
We'll have a little canapé feast for them tasting.
Fantastic. Yeah. We look forward to it. Great. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Stick thank around you. For Tech Bites up at 11, and we'll see you next week.
Yay!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.